for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The unemployment rate unexpectedly fell to 9.5% in June. Earlier in the week, stocks tumbled on disappointing housing data and weakened consumer confidence. The financial reform bill cleared the House, but needs Senate approval after the Independence Day recess. President Obama said our immigration system is broken, and the Senate Judiciary Committee concluded hearings on Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. Joining me for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Juan Williams of NPR, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, and we welcome Sam Youngman of The Hill newspaper. Throughout the hour, I'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Remember, you can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to everybody.
Good morning.
And welcome, Sam.
Thanks
good to have you here. Juan Williams, the June unemployment numbers, how did they compare with our expectations?
Well, I think there was great concern that unemployment would rise and possibly go over 10%. And if that was the case, there was two levels of concern, Diane. One, that this would further encourage the thought that, you know what, we might be headed towards a double-dip recession. People are worried about news coming not only from Europe in terms of their economies, but even now from China. And the second level of concern, I think, was, had to do with the politics of it, which is that it would set the narrative in place going towards the November elections that, in fact, this economy, despite the stimulus package and the like that the Democrats have taken credit for, has not recovered, and that the focus on jobs has been lacking from an administration that instead has put its legislative agenda, health care and the like, ahead of simple focus on jobs.
Cheryl, you had a wave of census layoffs.
That's true, and that accounts for these job losses. But the administration has a little bit of good news to point to. There was some growth in private sector employment, and when President Obama came out and made his statement this morning, he said, we're headed in the right direction, but not fast enough. But he did point to the fact that we've had the sixth straight month of private sector employment growth, and so I would expect to see the administration and Democrats hanging on to that as a sign that they say there's continued healing, in the words of Christy Romer, the president's top economics advisor.
Sam, you had the unemployment rate fall because people gave up looking for jobs. Do you think, as Juan implied, there is still that worry about a double-dip recession?
I think so, simply because the housing numbers look so bleak and continue to send shudders through the spines of economists everywhere. And I do think that this is a big I think the White House is breathing a big sigh of relief today, because I do think, as Juan said, there was a real concern that we're going to see close to 10% today. While it's bad news for those people who quit looking for jobs, I think it's somewhat good news for the White House that they can claim that the unemployment rate is inching downwards on the strength of some meager private sector hiring.
To quote the president, he said to every American who's looking for work, I promise you we're going to keep on doing everything we can. He also said, I will do everything in my power to help our economy create jobs and opportunities for all people. What can he do, Cheryl?
Well, he's got to try to push a jobs bill through Congress. The Senate this week took up a small small business jobs bill. They've had trouble passing legislation to extend unemployment benefits and to promote jobs growth. And I think that it's going to be a problem for President Obama if something does not get through. It won't happen until after the 4th of July recess at the earliest. So we've still got at least a week or more before we know.
And, of course, stocks fell for six consecutive days, Juan.
Well, now stocks are down about 8%, Diane, for the year of 2010. And when you combine this to something that I think Sam was touching on earlier, which is that the numbers indicate that housing sales have fallen from April to May, down about 30%, that this is, you know, evidence of consumer confidence now. People are anxious. And if people are anxious, then they don't spend money. And if they don't spend money, then the economy starts to stall. And then we'll get back to that fear of double dip. But I think the stock market thing really speaks to global concerns at this point. And, you know, at the G20, at the start of the week, President Obama was saying we need to spend more money. We need to stimulate this economy in terms of producing growth. What he heard from the European nations is they believe in austerity and debt reduction. And when the American people are asked in polls right now, what do you think about the debt? That comes out as a huge concern. In fact, it's the number one attribute they're looking for in candidates that are running this November. They say they want somebody who's going to cut spending. Well, the Obama administration is saying, we need to make sure that we don't get back into an economic, trough. And so in order to do that, we want to make sure that the government is kind of priming the economic engine. But at the same time, people are saying, no, don't spend more money.
And we've just heard the AP is reporting factory orders falling 1.4% in May, the worst showing in 9 months, which really does cast doubt on the recovery.
Yes, I think so. But I'd like to actually pick up on a point that Juan made, which is that this tug between reducing the deficit and continuing to spend in order to keep the fragile economy alive and stable is very important and is going to be very problematic for the administration as it goes forward. Just this week, the Congressional Budget Office reported that gave its long-term forecast and said that the overhaul of the healthcare system has in fact done little to improve the fiscal outcut, that the deficit would likely continue rising. Juan said correctly that Americans are very concerned about the deficit, and yet at the same time, the administration has to be concerned about a repeat of the what happened during the Great Depression, when there wasn't enough spending or the government withdrew spending too quickly, and we saw serious problems in the economy linger for longer than many economists would argue they had to.
What about this House passed legislation, Sam, this financial reform bill?
Well, I think it's certainly getting closer to the president's desk. Clearly, there are a small group of senators who want to take the holiday recess to think about how they're going to vote. Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown again finds himself in the spotlight as the White House looks to him for another assist on another domestic a key domestic agenda item for the president. The White House is hoping that with the signature on that financial reform package, it'll send a signal of certainty to the markets. Right now, we don't know because there's just nothing but an uncertainty in the markets, which is why I think the White House recognizes that, which is why we saw the president take the unusual step this week of inviting reporters into the presidential economic briefing to hear from Ben Bernanke, Fed chairman. So clearly the White House is not unaware of the skittishness out there in the markets and with investors. But as far as what they can do to sort of halt that and right the ship, I think they're grasping for straws.
What about Maria Cantwell? Hasn't she sort of indicated that she will vote for this House passed bill one?
Well, she's looking at it, is what we're hearing. We don't know for sure, Diane. But now the criticism coming from the Republicans on this has led to a little bit of a political flare this week. The Republicans in the voice of John Boehner, the minority leader in the House, said this financial reform bill is like using a nuclear bomb to get rid of an ant. To which then President Obama responded, "Oh, so he thinks that the financial crisis in America is an ant, and he's out of touch with ordinary people." But the substance of the Boehner argument is this, that the bill is an expansion of big government. And of course, that appeals to lots of people who right now think government's too big, too intrusive and the like, that nothing on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, no effort there to restrain them, that Boehner makes the case that it's going to kill jobs, raise taxes, make it more likely, from the conservative point of view, that there will be more bailouts, another trigger word in terms of American politics right now. So on all these fronts, this is the argument coming, and it's why you're not seeing support from the right for financial reform, when you would think that most people would say, gosh, we just went through a terrible time, and Wall Street is to blame, if not wholly, partially.
I think, though, that eventually Republicans are going to come around. I still believe, and I could eat these words, that as we move closer to the election in November, it's going to be imperative on Republicans to say that they have done something to address the underlying conditions that created the economic collapse in the first place. And so I think we'll see after the 4th of July recess, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate come back to the table and try to figure out some adjustments to make to the House bill to get it through. One important point, the Democrats lost a vote this week with the death of Senator Robert Byrd. And so that makes it just a teensy bit harder for them.
The other element here is that Republicans continue to express great concerns about a growing government deficit, yet you continue to hear calls about why isn't the government doing more in the Gulf? Why isn't doing more to bring help, to bring assistance to those fishermen, to the oil workers, to all of those who need help, Sam?
Well, the White House would be the first to say that's definitely important, but it's going to be BP picking up the tab. We've certainly seen the president pressuring BP to move, which goes back to something Juan was talking about with John Boehner and his comparison of a nuclear weapon to an ant. The president's birthday isn't until August, but John Boehner, Joe Barton, they're giving him early birthday presents with some of these statements that are feeding right into this narrative.
Sam Youngman, he's White House correspondent with The Hill newspaper. Short break. We'll talk about immigration reform when we come back. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, Sam Youngman of the Hill newspaper, and Juan Williams. He's NPR news analyst and Fox News political analyst. He's also author of the book Enough. Join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Sam, tell us about the president's speech, which he made here at the American University. I was fortunate enough to be in the audience. What do you say?
Well, he made it very clear where he stands on the immigration issue, and he made it very clear where he does not. What he didn't offer were a great deal of specifics about how to move this forward legislatively. A number of Republicans who have signed on to immigration reform in the past, so they were very disappointed with the president's speech yesterday, because simply he was painting them into a corner, putting the onus on them to get something done, and saying they lack the political will and the courage to do so. So I think what we're hearing from the president is we know where he stands. We know he wants to address the issue. But the odds of that happening this year, I would say, are slim to none.
It was interesting. He even brought up the name of former President George W. Bush, saying he had been in favor of addressing immigration problems. Is this dead on arrival, Cheryl?
Well, it's certainly dead this year with an election in November. I was struck by how closely the president's plan resembled the plan put forth by President Bush and that very nearly passed 5 years ago. It's a plan that would combine border security with requirements on illegal immigrants that they admit they pay the law, that they pay back taxes.
And learn English.
And learn English before seeking permanent residency. And yet it seems like it's going nowhere, that this, while this was a policy speech, or the White House would say it was a policy speech, really it was a political speech to set the groundwork for Democrats who want to be seen as addressing this issue this year. Democrats like Harry Reid in Nevada, for instance, who's up on it for a tough fight.
But if he hadn't made some statement, Juan, he would have been harshly criticized.
By the Hispanic community in specific, if you look at the numbers right now, you know, obviously the black community remains very strongly supportive of President Obama. The white community's approval ratings are down in about the 40s. In the middle of the Hispanic community, and they've been dropping. Now, it's interesting to note that, you know, Sonia Sotomayor is on the Supreme Court because of an Obama nomination, but that hasn't quieted the Hispanic sense that they want President Obama to live up to his campaign promise, which was that he would deal with this immigration issue forthwith as the minute he took office. And obviously, we're more than a year since he's been in office, and it hasn't come to any kind of legislative package or a vote. So what you get is a lot of pressure now to say something should be done. But it's coming at a moment when the Arizona law is out there and most Americans support the Arizona law. It's also the case, according to the polls, that most Americans support some pathway for, you know, people who are in the country legally to make themselves legal citizens of the country. And I have a good source who told me that in the audience at American University this week was not only you, but also people like Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City.
And Mort Zuckerman.
Who's the publisher, I should say, of the New York Daily News. And Rupert Murdoch, head of Fox, has also come out. And I saw this morning in the paper a wonderful ad from the Carnegie Institute, just showing Americans all the amazing people who were born overseas who have contributed so much to America. So I think that there's this growing sense that something needs to be done. This was part of the argument that appealed to me in what President Obama said. He said he thinks that, you know, it's just time to get something done on this issue, to not get locked up in the political polarization and the rhetoric.
At the same time, he really did single out Republican resistance on this issue.
Sure. He really did. And he pointed to Republicans like Senator John McCain, who, not by name, but everyone knew who he was talking about, who had supported the President Bush's initiative 5 years ago and who have flipped around.
So
and,
what's changed?
Well, what's changed is politics for some of these Republicans. Certainly Senator McCain is facing a very difficult re-election challenge from the right. And in a state like Arizona, where obviously immigration, as Juan said, is a hot button issue, they've passed this very tough law. He can't afford to be for immigration reform right now if he wants to keep his seat.
Well, that's exactly right. And Juan really nailed hit the nail on the head when he said that the president is losing Hispanics. It's been a consistent and continuing drop and with a key core constituency. So I think the White House sees a lot of room for political gain here, if not political damage control, simply by putting the onus on the John McCains of the world, who are virtually unrecognizable now compared to where they were, especially just out in front of this issue in 2005, 2006. But I think the thing to remember is 2006, it almost destroyed the Republican Party. It really did divide a wedge that now has a name called the Tea Party. I don't think Democrats are necessarily eager to jump on this either. Mm. But as long as they can paint Republicans as the bad guys, as the obstructionist on something of this magnitude, then I think it can still be a win for the White House and Democrats.
So you believe the president will continue to talk about it, continue to say Republicans who are against it, we're all for it, with a few exceptions, knowing full well it's not going to go anywhere.
This president has a tell, like a poker player. If he wants something done, he puts a deadline on the table. He put repeated deadlines on the table for health care. He's done it for Guantanamo Bay. Now, with health care, he missed deadlines. Congress missed deadlines. But the White House and aides there said, you don't get anything done without a deadline. There is no deadline for this. There is no deadline for energy legislation. So it's all well and good for the president to say he wants something done this year. But unless he's really pushing Congress to do so, then we know how much they want it.
And it's only going to get harder for him. We know that Democrats will lose seats in November, and so the Senate and the House will be less favorable to the president and his agenda next year. So I don't know how it's going to turn out on this.
One of the really important issues is the question of illegal immigrants whose children have been born in this country. And as far as I understand, the Constitution says, if you're born here, you're a U.S. citizen. Is there any effort to turn that around, Juan?
Yes, there is. And this is a surprise, but there's efforts coming out of the Tea Party types that Sam was talking about, who people are saying, well, people come over the border who when they're pregnant with the intention of establishing citizenship for that child, and that it is nothing but a ploy and a stealth effort to just get the child citizenship, and it's not something we should abide. And so there are efforts now in some states, pretty much coming from local legislators, to try to stop it.
I can't imagine. I mean, it just opens up a can of constitutional issues that, that really I think would terrify even the most longtime constitutional scholar. I think that's an issue that's further down the road. I think right now you're talking about the big stuff, the 11 million illegal aliens who are here. You're talking about the president's defining it in terms of amnesty versus mass deportations. So I think right now, obviously you are seeing, as Juan mentioned, a growing initiative on the state level to do something about that. But I think, again, it stems from what the president's calling the frustration at the state level with the federal government for failing to get something done.
We've also seen in a very poignant way how children can put a face in this debate. Not that long ago, Mrs. Obama was speaking to a school and a little girl raised her hand and said something to the effect, what my mommy says, you're going to send people away without their papers. And come to find out, as she disclosed, this young child, that her mom was here as an undocumented person. And it was very heart-wrenching, and there was a whole flurry about, whoa, is this family going to be deported now that this girl has outed her mother in front of the First Lady? And nobody wanted to see that happen, but it really put a face on this complicated problem.
All right, and you spent a great deal of your week, Cheryl, at the Elena Kagan hearings. Tell us about it.
Well, one thing I can say is that Elena Kagan will be the next Supreme Court justice. Even Republicans are saying so. She will be confirmed. She did very, very well at her hearings. She was very knowledgeable, as everybody expected she would be, but she was also quite charming. She showed flashes of humor. She was very playful with the senators. At one point, Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, said to her, "Where were you this past Christmas?" And she was he was trying to ask her about the airline bombing plot, and she leaned back and she said, "Well, like most Jews, I was probably at a Chinese restaurant," and it absolutely brought
drinking,
the house down.
Didn't she say drinking tea?
She
or
might have, but
like
it absolutely
that.
Brought the house down. And by the time it was over, even Tom Coburn, the conservative from Oklahoma, said to her, "You light up a room." Now, that doesn't mean Republicans will vote for her, but it does mean that she charmed them. And with an overwhelmingly Democratic Senate, it seems clear that she'll be confirmed.
No Republican filibuster on Elena Kagan, Juan?
No, no evidence of any support for that idea, but it's interesting sort of in my mind to contrast this to Sonia Sotomayor, the president's last nominee. Now, it was, I think that the numbers I think are that she got 68 votes last time. This was last August. And this time I would think that maybe she will get Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham seems open possibly to voting for her. Maybe Scott Brown, the new senator from Massachusetts, might vote for her. She's regarded, although she's a Manhattanite, she's regarded as having lived much of her life in Massachusetts, the dean of Harvard and the like. But the NRA has come out against her. And the NRA's decision means that she will be, that any Republican who votes for her will have his or her name put up in lights by the NRA as somebody who is against their position in terms of gun rights. And this week, of course, you had that case out of Chicago affirming the Second Amendment right of individuals to own guns. And, you know, that puts Kagan in a tough situation when she was asked in her earlier life about gun rights, especially the Heller case here in the District of Columbia. She said she was not sympathetic to people, individuals, owning guns, and she interpreted the Second Amendment as meaning the militia has a right to bear arms.
Boy, all these dots you see connecting around the Beltway. Go ahead.
Right. Well, Elena Kagan, as Cheryl said, is immensely likable and very charming, but she will not enjoy the bipartisan support that Sotomayor enjoyed simply because it's an election year. And there's also, I mean, there's a great guide to be able to use to figure out who will vote for her because the Senate voted for her last year. Who voted for her for Solicitor General? I believe there were 9 Republican senators who voted for her. Of those, Coburn, Kyle, Hatch. These are guys that either have serious reelection concerns or they're very much listening to the Tea Party and they can't be seen as crossing the aisle to vote for this, what they would call a very liberal Supreme Court nominee.
Yeah, I actually have a piece in today's paper examining what kind of GOP support she would get. 9 Republicans voted for Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Interesting to note that none of them are facing reelection this year. And in fact, 4 are retiring. 1 is already gone, Mel Martinez. And I think Juan is correct. The NRA and the gun rights issue will be important in this vote.
Cheryl K. Stolberg of the New York Times. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What kind of justice do you think she'll be?
I think she said it best herself when she said, if you confirm me, you'll get Justice Kagan, you won't get Justice Marshall. A lot of talk at these hearings about would she be Thurgood Marshall? Would she be an activist justice? She certainly won't be Antonin Scalia, but nor will she be a liberal firebrand on the court. I think we saw someone who does talk about adhering to precedent, does talk about deferring to Congress, in fact, so much so that some Republicans say they are uneasy about it because they fear she would not strike down expansive laws like the health care bill. But I think we will see a careful left-of-center justice who is not pushing the law hard in a leftward direction, but is certainly not going to push it rightward.
Yeah, I don't think President Obama ever questioned her legal mind, because we've seen she does have a very sharp legal mind. I think what he was looking for was somebody more than mold of a John Paul Stevens who could work with the other justices, sway some votes, bring some people to her side. Now, I think Cheryl's right. She's not a liberal firebrand, but on some of these big issues, especially in this last term of the court where we saw a lot of 5-4 divides and a markedly conservative direction on the Roberts Court, I think we've seen Elena Kagan is the type of person who probably could win some support and bring some votes to her way.
And we already have her on record in one of the most hotly contested cases, the Citizens United case, in which the court struck down corporate limits on corporate spending and campaigns. She argued that case as Solicitor General and said during the hearings that she felt that they had a very strong argument. And that argument obviously wound up in the minority. She was the court did not find in her favor.
All right. Let's turn to the confirmation of General Petraeus. Not so much as to what he's going to do in the war, but does his confirmation present any problems for President Obama?
Juan. Well, it was so overwhelming. I think it was 99 votes in favor of General Petraeus. What this does is really say that General Petraeus is leading the strategy, the war in Afghanistan. I think it'd be very difficult for President Obama, who has scheduled a December review, to do anything but agree with General Petraeus. So it's a little bit of the tail wagging the dog here. But what you see going out is that General Petraeus feels, for the moment, and this is what he said in testimony, that he not only supported the president's plan for setting a date for withdrawal, July of 2011, but that he agreed with it, that he thinks it's a good idea to have a deadline in mind. But for the moment, the chatter around Washington is, does the president keep the diplomatic team that surrounds the military team in place?
Holbrooke.
Esther Eikenberry, obviously going to keep Secretary Clinton in place. But the question is, these are people who have been in strong argument. I would throw Vice President Biden in here about exactly what is the U.S. policy in Afghanistan. We're now into the 10th year of this struggle. It's been 30 years that people have been trying to handle this. There were some very interesting numbers that came forward this week, Diane, that said, and I don't have them in front of me, but they're numbers that have suggested there are about, 50 Al-Qaeda people in Afghanistan, about another 250 over in Pakistan. And we're going to have, we don't have them fully on the ground yet, 100,000 people. Well, wait a second.
And
what kind of strategy is this?
Billions of dollars.
And so you see a declining appetite in the American mind for this war effort. You hear the term Vietnam being bandied about more often than ever. At the same time, there are people, especially on the right, who are doubting President Obama's willingness to pay the price and to win this war. And now the analogy on the right is not Vietnam, but going back to Iraq and the fact that the surge, operated by none other than General Petraeus, was a success.
I think this is potentially a very difficult problem for President Obama. He ran for office saying that we had focused on the wrong war, Iraq. He was going to pull out of Iraq and focus on Afghanistan and win it. The situation there is very difficult. General Petraeus himself has said this is the tough war. He was able to be successful in Iraq, but he knows and everyone else knows that it's a much tougher task in Afghanistan. And if we run out of there with our tails between our legs, President Obama will be in trouble.
Cheryl K. Stoltberg at the New York Times. Short break. When we come back, your calls and remembrances of Senator Robert Byrd.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. General Petraeus takes over in Afghanistan. Russia denies charges of spying in the U.S. and new estimates of Al-Qaeda's strength. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. We'll go right to the phones to Jackson, Mississippi. Good morning, Joanne. You're on the air.
Joanne from Jackson, Michigan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
No, that's okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
But now I'm all into Afghanistan and immigrants, but that's not why I called.
All right.
I'll leave that aside. Okay. I would like your two guests to address two things. Foreclosures in the USA, and it's not just happening in my community. I know Michigan has been hit extra hard, but I've spoken to friends in California, in Arizona, and in Texas, and the same thing is happening there. And I'm not against tenants and renters. For 90% of my adult life, I was a renter. Okay, but what's happening in my community and other communities is first-time buyers and families are not buying up these foreclosed homes at cheap prices. It's moneyed people who are buying them from income property, turning them into rentals, and renting to people they certainly wouldn't want living in their communities. Some of the old houses around here are being turned into duplexes. So I would really like you people to address that. And if you know some kind of percentage, because this is happening in other neighborhoods.
What do you think, Juan?
I think that she's on target. I mean, it's happening all over the country. I don't know the exact percentage, but what you see is in places like Michigan that she's talking about, higher levels of foreclosure because of economic distress. Now, this is particularly true in the Black community, I might add, that you see high levels. I think Pew had some numbers out this week and indicated about half of the foreclosures impact minorities in the country. So what you're seeing is, again, poor people who are on the line. And part of the financial reform package, by the way, is about trying to get better regulation of the credit agencies that were putting this out there. It's something that, of course, is going to be difficult for people who have been on the line in terms of their ambition to own a house, the so-called ownership society that the Bush administration had favored. But if you have money, right now is not a bad time to get in the market.
Well, a lot of people are doing it. On the other hand, even here in Washington, there were stories of discounted houses from millions down to fewer millions,
right,
people buying them up. So sounds as though the wealthy are taking advantage of it. To Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to offer an opposing view of Robert Byrd. I mean, I've been hearing these kind of, you know, warm, fuzzy remembrances of Robert Byrd, like he was, you know, some kind of kind, grandfatherly figure. Well, I was listening to your show several years ago when you were having open lines, and you had this Black woman who identified herself as a member of the Capitol Police, and after 9/11, she had to go to Robert Byrd's house and, you know, act as a security guard because it was thought that there was going to be, you know, some kind of attack, you know, on the members of Congress. Now, it was this woman and a white male police officer. They had to stay out all night guarding this woman's, guarding Robert Byrd's house. And in the morning, they asked to use his restroom. And Robert Byrd let the white man use his restroom, but he told the woman to go down and use the restroom at the gas station down the street. Now, I'm just wondering if you remember this story, and, you know, I was...
Michael, I'm not sure anyone here at the table remembers this story. That's not to say you may not have heard it accurately, but not everybody has all warm, fuzzy memories.
I think that's absolutely correct. And, you know, Robert Byrd was a morally complicated person. We know that in his early career, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. That was, in fact, how he rose to power. And he spent many, many decades apologizing for that and calling it a sad mistake. So while we are given to remembering the good things about him, his past is complicated. And I thought Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, said it very well this week when he said Robert Byrd was an argument for why you should never judge a person at the end of their life based on just one thing they had done. And I thought that summed it up very well.
All right. Thanks for calling, Michael. To Merceal in Decatur, Indiana. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning. I wanted to say a couple of things about immigration and the broken system.
Sure.
First thing, that I believe the presence of all these millions of undocumented people is a kind of non-military invasion. They don't belong here. I believe that what is broken about the system is really the failure to enforce our laws. I believe that if you reward bad behavior, you will get more bad behavior. And I think past amnesties have showed us that we got way more undocumented people from all over the world. And I don't, it really upsets me when people put the focus only on Hispanics. Part of my background is Hispanic, and it's not just Hispanics. But I'm very much against any path to citizenship or even to legalization, because I believe that we will simply get more of the same problem. I also feel that it's a not exactly a power grab, but that Hispanic activists are seeing all these possible new Hispanic citizens, and it's power for them that they don't deserve.
All right. Thanks for calling, Sam.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a point when she says it's a non-military invasion that's reflective of the views of a great segment of America. I do think a path to citizenship, both the president and Republicans have long agreed that you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Mass deportations would have just a harrowing effect on our economy, on our communities, on really just the moral fabric of this country, to see these horrible pictures you would see, I think, of people being rounded up in the middle of the night.
And one thing the president did say yesterday in terms of failure to enforce laws, he said there are more boots on the ground now than ever before.
And that's true.
And trying to protect that border, but...
But you're never going to have enough boots to round up 11 million
right.
people and send them back home. It's just impractical, as irritating as it may be to people like our caller. It's not a practical solution.
But the caller seemed to agree with the president. She said, you know, bad behavior rewards bad behavior. The president said the same thing yesterday. He said amnesty would only encourage more illegal immigration.
Here's an email on the same subject from Sam in Silver Spring, Maryland. First, he asks, is there any way Congress moves on immigration reform this year? I think you are unanimous in saying a big no. And if not, he goes on to say, how can Democrats look like they're doing something before the midterm election?
Well, that's pretty easy. Well, you point at the Republicans and say, look at people like John McCain. John McCain was willing to work with George W. Bush back in 06 on some kind of immigration reform. Today, facing J.D. Hayworth in Arizona and Tea Party people who are strongly anti-immigrant reform, the Republicans are backing off. He can't even get Richard Lugar of Indiana to play ball. You know, look at what happened to Bob Bennett of Utah. Bob Bennett's not going to play ball this time around. I could, you know, there's several names like that, people who you thought were saying, I'm willing to stand up to those who are just furious, like the caller, about the size, the magnitude of illegal immigrants in the country. People who say, you know, you go down to the gas station, there's nobody who speaks English. You know, what's going on at the 7-Eleven? Remember Vice President Biden's thing about the Dunkin' Donuts in Wilmington, Delaware, all owned by East Indians. People, they're especially older white people, are like, well, what's with all these people here, you know, and feel very threatened. But at the moment, it's not the case that you can get most conservative Democrats to try to buck that political tide, much less the Republicans.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Diane. The issues, all these issues that people have been talking about, one thing that comes through to me is we seem to be lacking politicians who have the courage to care about anything except election. And it's unfortunately to me, I can't see the Republican Party having been interested in anything except winning elections, given the changes, their willingness to grab hold of any argument and use it as a mallet to beat the opposition, rather than trying to move forward to govern our country.
Sam?
I don't think that's unique just to the Republican Party. I think Democrats are also willing to seize on just about any issue that they can turn into political gain. I think the caller certainly echoes the president's point that this would take, an issue like immigration would take a certain amount of political will and courage to be able to, you know, risk a person's own reelection in an effort to get something done. That being said, the White House can do more than just talk. Democrats can do more than just talk and castigate Republicans for this. They could put some force in legislation. The president could say, I want to see this. I want to see movement on this by August. But none of those things are happening either.
And to Delray Beach, Florida. Hi, Michael. Michael.
Hello?
Yes, are you there? Go right ahead, sir.
Yes. I wanted to address the earlier thing about employment, which I think is one of the major problems in the country, and it affects immigration and so forth. And I'm a disabled veteran, and I have a website, which is WPA with the number for vets. And I think beyond veterans, which I'm trying to help because they need help, needless to say, the government should have a WPA program right now. Instead of giving money to the banks and so forth, I think that if we started a WPA, we could rebuild our infrastructure, we could employ people, that would trickle down and pick the economy up. The banks would do, everybody would do well. And unfortunately, everybody's too busy with partisan politics to think about the ultimate fact that we need to employ people in this country.
Michael, thank you for your service. I think there are an awful lot of people out there who agree that jobs should have been number one, Cheryl.
I think so. I think, first of all, the White House would say, well, we had a $787 billion stimulus package, which put money into sort of quote-unquote shovel-ready projects. But, of course, that was some 18 months ago when that passed. And the caller is correct. Americans are concerned about jobs. We saw the president at the outset of this year saying jobs, jobs, jobs. We haven't really seen the follow-through. Still no jobs bill through Congress. So going into this election, that is going to be a tough issue for him.
Can anybody tell me what's happened to those shovel-ready projects?
I see the signs all the time that say this road is being paid for by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The problem is most Americans don't see that. The Recovery Act was essentially, in part, a WPA-like program. The president, the White House, has to figure out why they're not able to, why Americans don't know that, why this gentleman, why this caller doesn't know that they are trying to do things like that to rebuild the infrastructure and rebuild the economy at the same time.
I think also it would be politically impossible to create a WPA-type agency right now simply because there's so much sentiment on the other side against big government. So you couldn't just create some new big government agency. Instead, they did it through legislation, through this law, and Americans don't see that as a concrete thing.
The reason, I think there's something else going on. I mean, obviously, by the way, I just had mentioned that I think it was just 2 weeks ago, Vice President Biden, President Obama said, you know, this is going to be the summer where you can see all these stimulus programs on highways, construction, infrastructure, and the like. But I think the reason is this, that much of the money went into bucking up states that were suffering deficit problems and even on Medicaid spending, you know, to make sure that you could have those health care programs sustained and not draining state budgets. The consequence was that states were able to retain teachers, policemen, public service workers. The Republican criticism has been that's not generated private sector jobs. And why are you, you know, always talking about losing policemen and school teachers? You know what? They say fire the bureaucrats. They don't like the bureaucrats.
Juan Williams of NPR. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Shelby Township, Michigan. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'd like to return to the Kagan hearings just to address something that I found a little peculiar from the Republican senators that were on the panel. They repeatedly, you know, brought up Thurgood Marshall as, you know, kind of an example of a bad justice or some, you know, a justice that one would not aspire to be like. And, you know, obviously he's an icon of American jurisprudence and arguably as responsible as anyone for ending legalized discrimination.
All right. Juan, you wrote the book on Justice Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah, it was a kind of interesting thing. I think Elena Kagan has escaped damage from this association. She was a Marshall clerk. But the idea that Marshall was this wild-eyed activist judge is just so bizarre to me because, in fact, he was viewed as someone who was a law and order man, and even in arguments like the Brown decision or affirmative action, always did it in a strict constitutional framework that said, hey, this is the Constitution and the amendments should deliver on equal justice for all without regard to color. And I don't think anybody, not even the Republicans who were saying this week, he's one of these activist judges and wants results-oriented decisions that have nothing to do with law, could point to an instance where he violated the Constitution or broke the law.
Another striking thing was that Republicans were making these arguments with Justice Marshall's son, Goody Marshall, in the audience. He is a backer of Elena Kagan's and spent the entire time at the hearings listening to these senators disparage his father.
Last word, Sam.
Well, I think Cheryl hit the nail on the head earlier when she said that what we're hearing from Elena Kagan is that she's promising to be Justice Kagan and not Justice Marshall.
All right, Dan. Just in honor of Senator Robert Byrd, as we go out, you'll hear him singing and playing. Thanks to Sam Youngman, Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, Juan Williams. Have a good, healthy, safe 4th of July weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Got my razor, my Gatling gun, going up Cripple Creek, going in a run, going up Cripple Creek to have a little fun, going up Cripple Creek, going in a run. Going up Cripple Creek, going in a whirl, going up Cripple Creek to see my girl, going up Cripple Creek to have a little fun, going up Cripple Creek, going in a run. We'll be right back.